Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
Well, hey, Anna David here. You are listening, or you are about to listen to After Party Pod, the podcast about addiction recovery and all that falls between. I think that's become the tagline. I don't mind it. If you have suggestions for other taglines, I'm open to those as well. It's a work in progress. And it's interesting because I do feel like it has been a work in progress. You know, for better or worse, I jumped into this podcast frame really with no idea what the right way to go about it was. It's actually the way I wrote books too. I just started doing it. I picked it up. I really liked what I was hearing, and so I tried to do it. And I would say I didn't know what I was doing at first, and it's possible that I still don't, but it feels of late like it's gotten into a groove where at least I know I'm enjoying myself a lot more during these interviews than I used to, where I would sort of be in a constant state of not being in the moment, where I would be asking myself, you know, am I talking too much? Or am I asking the right questions? And I could never feel like I was in a conversation. And lately, it's just seemed to be these conversations. I think I've relinquished control somewhat. And I try to keep those unpleasant reviews out of my head. There was a new one where somebody said that the entire podcast is me going, right, which is something that they're not wrong. Like all criticism, it's not all criticism has a point, but that completely does. And I was conscious of that during this, and I tried not to do it. But when I remember, you know, I wrote Tom Sizemore's book, and I remember him telling me that when he talked, I would go, right. I don't know. I mean, I'm basically saying keep talking. I'm not going to interrupt you, but I'm not asleep either. So I get that there are other ways to do that and to say that, and just to say nothing is a possibility and just sort of nod enthusiastically. But anyway, today's guest is Bennett Yellen. He is somebody that I've known, I think, about, I want to say 8 or 9 years. He is a screenwriter. In fact, he wrote Dumb and Dumber with the Farrelly brothers and the sequel to Dumb and Dumber, which is coming out this November. And he is so fabulous. He has never failed to make me laugh. And it occurred to me that he would be a great guest for this when, you know, I know him through recovery. And he and my very good friend, who is going to be a guest, a future guest, I haven't asked him yet, but, you know, whatever. I got him to go to Spain with me, so I think I can get him to come on this podcast. We'll see. But my friend John is very close with Bennett. And so we met, and John and Bennett used to have a internet radio show. This was almost pre-podcasts, I would say. They were ahead of their time, trendsetters. And it was on something that was like a recovery network, and they had a show called The Hollywood Pitch. And Bennett and I get into this in this interview, but they would talk about addiction in Hollywood. And I used to go on that show, and it was a lot of fun. And so it occurred to me, God, Bennett is open about this stuff. And I, you know, I should ask him. And he delightfully said yes. And he was here this morning. And I learned so much about him that I did not know. And I got to hear things that I did know said in very clever, funny ways. He's just a naturally happy guy. We can all be envious of that. But he's you know, I'm going to stop talking, and I'm going to tell you that you will very much enjoy Bennett Yellen. So here he is.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh, my God. I think my copy has, like, bloodstains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Well, I'm about to test it.
Okay.
And now that we're now that we're, as they say, live.
Yes.
I could really abuse my powers and ask you all sorts of things.
By the way, who is they when you're talking about they say that we're live? I need names. Just be specific.
No, I say. I'm talking about me and my many, many personalities, only some of whom you know.
That I get. Okay.
But it's so good to see you, because how long has it been?
I hate to think about it.
I know,
because
it's
painful.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't be.
No, but it's also painful how quickly time passes.
That's true as well.
Yeah. Right?
Every angle is uncomfortable. Let's just drop
just
it. We don't know
everywhere.
How long. Yeah.
But my memory of you, my strongest memory of you, is being in some sort of parking lot after maybe seeing a movie or something with John and just laughing hysterically and me saying to myself, I need to make Bennett mine. Like, he's John's right now, but I need him to be in my inner circle. And I don't think I was ever successful. It's not that I've given
up. Don't tell anyone this?
Yeah. No. Okay. I mean, I'm still, this is all part of it, probably.
I always felt the tug of war when we were all together. And it was painful.
You know, I know. Speaking of pain.
There's a lot of, you know, it was like being in a horrible riptide, you know. And
yes. Well, it was like being in a like a codependent family.
Right, exactly. And I did. It was a triangular sort of dynamic.
No,
and I didn't
don't mock my desires. So you and John had a show, as we were just talking about, called The Hollywood Pitch.
Yes.
On this thing, I was just looking it up last night because I couldn't remember the details. There was something called the Recovery.
Something Network. The Something Recovery Network.
It was a radio station-ish.
Right. Yeah, I know. Although it was on, it was internet-y.
Ahead of its time.
Right. It was not, you couldn't actually go to your radio and listen to it.
You'd have
to go to
your
televisual phony internet and then listen to it. Yes. It was fun. I can't believe that we did it. When I think back, I can't believe that I showed up like every Wednesday, just about every Wednesday to do it. It blows my mind, actually, that I was that regular,
I was thinking about that with John, too, just that you guys, and that he would book all those guests, and it was like he would do research, and you would do research, I'm sure.
Yeah. No.
That was the thing.
That was the beauty of it.
Yeah.
He did it all.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to do a thing. I just showed up.
Yeah.
And like I wasn't even a second banana. I was like beneath. I was like a
you
12th
got
banana.
You got billing like you were a second. That's
yeah,
the ideal
that's how
scenario.
Desperate they were. Yes. It was
fun. I was looking up who they were.
Yeah.
Those are legit people in the.
There were about five legit people.
No, but like there was like Dr. Torrington is this huge addiction doctor, and you know he was doing it, and
we had like some celebrities too, and
I was considered a celebrity.
I wasn't there for
I
ours.
I think I did it several times. Did you specifically?
I must have. Like, don't get a complex about fact that I might have not been there, but I don't think I was ever there for yours.
Yeah.
It would have been a fun one, too.
They were always fun.
Yeah. And John, it was just great because John, the technician was fantastic. He was, I think his name was Kevin or Kyle, right.
Okay.
I knew it started with a K. He was hilarious, so there was a lot of interplay with him.
Oh, nice.
It was nothing for me. I just showed up. I just shooed up and just tried not to get in the way. And every time I think of something funny or rarely insightful to add, I do that.
I doubt that.
Great.
So how long are you sober now?
What time is it?
You got up early
12
this morning.
Twelve years, March 4th, 2002. So
okay.
Mm-hmm. I love, by the way, I don't mean to interrupt, but I will constantly
do
the metaphoric March 4th date, because I always say. It's when I marched forth out of my slavery into freedom. Isn't that great? And I was...
That's not why you decided to get sober that day.
No,
it was later you realized.
It just so happened that it had a lovely poetic twang to it. But,
that's so nice. Do you share that every anniversary?
Actually, pretty much. Yeah, people are probably sick of hearing about it. I do.
Oh, God, here comes that guy.
He's going to tell
us. Better skip the meeting on March 4th.
It's the same thing, like you know... I never try and come with something.
Yeah.
You know, but if I'm sharing what it was like, what happened, it's going to be the same crap. So when I start by saying, you know, I was raised an Orthodox Jewish, I can hear eyes rolling.
Wait, is that true?
Yes.
How could I not have known that
about you.
I waited for this moment.
Oh my God! So this is something like juicy an intervention, but of me finding out yes. about your Orthodox
you're
Judaism.
You're intervening to stop me from being Orthodox Jewish. Thank you.
I always knew I had a calling. Hold on, let's go yeah. way back.
Are we cutting for a commercial? No, no commercials on this.
No, you know, because, you know, I try to, like, Google a lot of stuff about people, and, you know, you're very
elusive.
Well, I could find out that you were a Scorpio. That was listed
yes,
online.
Yes, that is true.
But that's about the most I could get.
But you don't even know my birth date.
I think it was on IMDb. Is it wrong?
Was it? No, IMDb would be accurate.
I don't remember it.
Rarely.
Because
but.
I'm just what do they call? Like
you did your
line?
You did your research.
Oh, you can tell. When it's someone I love and adore, I don't need to research. It's about a heart-to-heart connection.
You just need to ask, baby.
Yeah. So now I'm going to ask. So you were born and raised where?
In Los Angeles, California.
In the city proper.
In the city improperly.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
But what part of the city?
Well, we lived in Westchester at the time.
Okay.
Westchester is that, when you're driving to the airport, there's this beige blur. Just before, that's Westchester, right by the airport.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
In fact, I used to have piano lessons right by the airport, and then they literally bought all the houses to expand the airport, but my piano teacher refused, so she was the only house on an empty lot, and they literally, we'd have to stop because the house would start shaking. It's like a Woody Allen movie. The house would start shaking, we couldn't hear anything because the planes were rerouted over her house.
She probably could have made, like...
She probably did by holding out.
Yeah, I mean, she could have quit teaching kids piano. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's like, I won the lottery, and I want to go back to the tire factory. okay.
See, I'm thinking you didn't keep up with your piano teacher, you callous man.
I didn't. As soon as she got all that money,
yeah,
she didn't keep
she
up with me.
You.
We called the number, and nobody answered.
So there you are in Westchester, Los Angeles.
Yes. Orthodox Jewish.
Orthodox Jewish.
Only Orthodox Jews in Westchester that we were aware of. We belonged to a Reform temple.
Okay.
Because there wasn't any other option. And we walked, you know, Orthodox Jews, on the Sabbath, you...
Walk?
You'd walk, and there's a lot of restrictions. So I didn't go out and play on the weekends. And walk to temple on Friday nights and Saturday. And
how many Yellens were there?
There was my parents and my two sisters. I have two older sisters.
Two
I'm the youngest.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
I knew we bonded for some reason. Right?
Do you have? Are you the youngest?
I'm the youngest.
Yeah.
Oh my God! What a cute little
thing.
Youngest you were. Did your sisters? Did they baby you?
They would. Get together and completely isolate me. So they had that. I don't know what this language was, but I'm going to say it's like, they had a special language
God,
they would talk around me. Then my parents would speak Yiddish because they knew it and they didn't want us to hear with it. So I had to do a little creating on my own, but I love my sisters. They were really sweet.
What is that Wadagi? I remember.
I have to ask them.
It's not Pig Latin.
It's not Latin. No, I don't think they would be speaking. It was some weird thing.
Yeah.
And they would do it in front of me like to piss me off. And
yeah.
I could never figure it out. I was like, you know, trying to crack the cipher. It was like, you know, Alan Turing. I couldn't crack the code.
And then your parents are speaking Yiddish, but Yiddish isn't so indecipherable.
Well, no, I mean, Yiddish, I call Yiddish German with a sense of humor, because German is so, like, so frighteningly guttural, and Yiddish is, like hilarious. It's like...
So were they funny? Did you get your humor from these
people? No, my parents are the sweetest, they were the sweetest people, but not particularly funny. I don't know where it came from in my family, but it was just sort of like a... Something that developed, like a pearl develops because it's a grid of sand.
Yeah.
My humor was my grid of sand.
Yeah.
Wow.
You are like a pearl.
I've never said, I'm like a...
You just started...
I'm like one of those weirdly shaped ones that they throw in the pile and then give to the kids. I disagree.
So there you are. There you are, Orthodox Jew.
Yes.
Funny. Only funny person in the family. Possibly the sisters are funny. I'm just going to let me go.
No, you're right. I'm not going to correct you.
And there everyone's speaking in different languages, and here you are.
Yeah.
And did you
they'll all deny this, by the way. They'll say, oh, we talked to you. They did. But they were teamed up. My sisters were a team, you know. They were
you
very
can't
close.
Deny that there's two pairs and then there's this other adorable boy.
Yeah.
And were you aware of the fact that you were gay? Is that something that came up as a kid?
It was very uncomfortable that I felt I loved Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
and I felt a tingling.
There Captain Kirk,
yes,
specifically,
yes.
Or Spock too.
Captain Kirk, because virtually every show, some alien ripped his shirt off in a very perfectly just to the pecs, just like it was Velcroed. You know, and I would sit really close and wait for that. And Captain Von Trapp.
I
had the hots for him.
I watched Brady Bunch, but that's a man, I assume.
Right? Yeah. No. Mike Brady. No. It was Yul Brynner, King and I, because he was wearing the pajama pants for the whole movie.
He didn't
have a top at all.
In the King and I?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, okay.
I would relate to them. I was attracted.
Right,
I didn't know
what that was. You just liked sitting
No
there.
Idea what it was.
Yeah.
But I also knew Charles Nelson Reilly and Paul Lynde and Tony Randall, their sense of humor,
right.
I totally got them. I said, I don't know why I relate to these guys, but I totally get them. So
but you weren't attracted to them?
Not attracted
and
to them.
And so how did so you could tell the difference between I am attracted to this and I am turned on by the humor of this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very much so. But there was I didn't understand what it was. I knew I was attracted. It was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because it's not like, you know, Rabbi, why am I feeling this?
Right.
You know, there's no, especially Captain Von Trapp.
Right.
And also with I am 60. The guy.
Oh.
The blonde, the area, the Nazi.
Yeah, yeah,
totally
attracted. Inappropriate to talk to the rabbi.
No.
Yeah.
Can't really say that to the rabbi.
So you didn't say anything to anybody?
No.
Okay.
And this developed the brilliant Bennett creation of smiling exterior. You don't know what kind of angst is going on behind me, which really that this was a life-saving technique of mine that probably extended my years of drinking and driving.
Are you doing it now?
Huh?
Because you are smiling a lot.
No, now it's just I've learned to marry it all and be. However, no, there's no question that like. Someone's saying something and I'm annoyed, I will smile. You won't know it. But that hasn't happened yet in this interview.
Give me time.
I am giving you time. But that became a lot. Seriously, that saved me because I had a lot of angst, a lot of anxiety about how I was feeling. A lot of voices. Boy, there were choruses of choruses in my head. You know, and because I was worried, something told me this attraction to men of my gender was not something that all the other guys at school, all the other kids at school were doing.
Yes.
So I had to keep it a secret. So that was scary because everything I did, I evaluated from all different angles. How will that look?
Of course.
Very exhausting. It was exhausting being me.
I know.
You know?
I know.
A lot of energy wasted on all that. You know?
So there you are, this little boy developing into a man. Can't tell anyone anything. When did you start drinking?
At 3. No.
Sounds like you needed one. I find that annoying when people are like,
I needed a drink.
I needed a drink at
6. Right,
yeah.
Right, really? You know? I mean, I didn't start drinking until I lived at home. Through high school, through college.
Through
I lived at
college.
Home through college because I went to UCLA, and UCLA was just, we had moved to Beverly. My dad said, around the time of my bar mitzvah, we need to be someplace where there are more Jews, more Orthodox Jews. So we moved to Beverly Hills, which is out of the frying pan into the fire, because the level of Orthodoxy in Beverly Hills was like serious Jew, and I was just sort of like, you know, I was just Orthodox by, you know, birthright. So
you were Orthodox light, your whole family, or just you?
The whole family.
Okay.
Yeah. But then I felt like the one thing that I thought was kind of a cool thing about me, like, you know, I'd be kosher, bringing my lunch to school and all that stuff. And, oh, Bennett's the Orthodox Jew. I thought, once I got to Beverly Hills, that was, I'm like the least Orthodox Jew.
So you liked being, you actually liked being
I appreciate,
unusual.
Right. I liked that special part of it, right?
So because nobody teased you or anything for it.
No, there was one house where when we were walking to temple on Saturday, they'd yell, Kai, Kai, yeah. Maybe it was kite. I'm not sure. You know, maybe the kids were going to play with their cat.
And you guys are just paranoid.
I know, because we are.
I mean,
for good reason.
You were telling me that you used to put towels up to block the sunlight, and I'm assuming that, you know.
That was toward the end.
Yes. Well, it was always in you.
Right. Just because you wanted to, I wanted to block out what was the reality that I knew I was not a part of, and that I was taking a vacation from, and that was not a great, not a healthy way for me to be splitting myself down the middle, you know.
Okay, but we got back to that. That was such a flash forward.
Totally a flash forward in a movie. This is like, you know, Scorsese cutting. Okay.
So you then are in Beverly Hills, and then you go to UCLA, and you live at home.
I lived at home, because UCLA is so close, yeah.
Did you like living at home? Were you...
I didn't even think about it. Right. It was just the thing to do. And I love my family.
Yeah.
And we all got along great. So it was not an uncomfortable place. But you know, but there was still the issue of my sexuality, which I didn't know how I was supposed to explore it. I'm living at home, and I was doing it in sort of like going out and exploring it in dark places at night. You know.
What does that mean?
That means like in do we really? It means like not the
houses?
Most. Well, I hadn't reached that point yet.
Okay.
But like in not the most legitimate ways to be exploring romance. You know?
Right.
You know, alleys and where gay sex reared its ugly.
Okay,
it's
like, I want to know about this because I don't know that much about gay sex. So
yes.
So you're in college, and how does one find an alley in which to experience gay sex?
You learn. You learn. You go to the bars. You learn. Usually the alleys are around the bars.
Yeah.
Tend to be right behind them. And
right. Convenient.
There was like a 3-block, right, there's a place called Circus of Books on Santa Monica Boulevard.
Okay. I was picturing you in Westwood. Okay. But now we're in West Hollywood.
No, right. We're in West Hollywood where most of the gay stuff was.
Yeah.
And behind Circus of Books, there were 3 blocks.
Oh, they're still
open. Well, they kind of closed the alleys in a way. And I mean, when I say that the line of cars was like a motorcade in an astronaut's parade in New York, that's how many cars there were on a Saturday night. That's what that neighborhood was like.
Wait, no, wait. So the cars are parked?
They're moving because they're cruising. The guys who are walking around.
Okay, and then the guys. They get the car.
You'd meet someone, and you'd get in the car, and you'd either go off or you'd go and park somewhere. And that's where I had... Hi, Mom. That's where I had my first adult sexual experience. I met somebody who walked down into the parking garage and went into the gardener's shack.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of hot.
As a result,
that's much better than a car.
You think it's hot, but I'm going to tell you this. I was terrified.
Yeah.
And the template of my first sexual experience with an adult was terror.
Really?
Which was not great.
Did he know what was going on more than you did?
No, I don't think so. I think he was just horny and
right. But he had had the experience before.
Yeah,
you
he seemed like a veteran. Yes,
okay.
He had all these medals. That's it.
No, I mean, sometimes we speak during sexual experiences, and someone will go, "This is my first time," and someone else will say, "Mine too."
This was way more curt than that.
Okay,
there wasn't about conversation
at
all,
right.
And it was It, as the template, it was fear, and that sort of became commensurate with my sexual experiences for a long time until I learned that it's about relaxing and making a connection and letting go, getting rid of the fear. Fear was a part of the whole thing, which is why things like drinking and drugging took away that element which is what was so appealing about liquor and so appealing about drugs.
So do you think that is one of the reasons you were drawn to alcohol and drugs, or do you think you were drawn to it anyway?
I think I was, because I wasn't drawn to it. I grew up, I was very kind of Philistine. I was like, oh, drugs and alcohol. It's so anti-establishment. How it would just, you know, grow your hair out long, get a guitar and sing a song.
So you were like 65 as a child.
Exactly. Like,
saying.
Oh, never do that.
Yeah.
Never do that crap. Huh, very funny. So,
and then what happened?
Then I went to graduate school.
Oh, so you were an innocent drinking wise and stuff in college?
Oh yeah, no, I didn't drink. I didn't drink in college.
You just had sex in garbage.
I just had sex in garbage, which is, you know, I mean, they're kind of the same.
Pretty much.
Right. Except a drink probably lasts longer.
A little bit. And then more people can relate. Right. So,
and okay. You get peanuts with a drink.
And so you go to graduate school also at UCLA?
No, I went to University of Massachusetts in Amherst, all the way to Amherst.
Okay.
Now I'm out of the nest. I'm away from home. I look around. I go, oh, maybe it's time to try things that I've never done before.
Right.
So first weekend of graduate school, in one night, I smoked pot, got drunk, and learned how to play poker all the same night. I say that because anyone who learns that the night you learn how to play poker, you take the pot. You are the best poker player. It's just a luck thing.
Oh,
and you're never that good again. Yeah. But that night, so
I've never learned. I'm excited for
the
that.
Night, oh, God, just bet crazy. The first night you play, bet crazy. You're going to do great.
So you, first of all, what were you studying in graduate school?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
I got it. This is not, I can't believe that they let me do this back then. I got at UCLA a BA in fiction and writing.
No, I got that. Oh, I mean, in creative writing, they called it.
Right, creative writing. And then I went for an MFA in fiction.
That's okay. You could still do that today.
You can still do that. Not as many places, but.
Yeah.
And then what are you going to do with that?
Exactly. Like,
I thought I was going to be a teacher. I thought I'd just teach writing. I thought I was going to be a good teacher.
Really? You would have been. I never wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Ironically, I'm teaching right now.
See, we
don't know.
Boy, we get sideswiped by the things we want least.
So there you are. You're getting an MFA in fiction, thinking you're going to be a teacher, and you have a great poker night.
I have a great poker night first weekend, and I still remember taking that drink. I remember when the drink hit and the pot hit, and this feeling that first of all the whole chorus gone in my head, and there was this incredibly restful silence, like snow falling.
Did you know that you had a chorus in your head? I mean, that wasn't something I realized.
Yes, I'm very aware of
really?
It. Yes, because I was aware of before I answer. I think, what if I say this? What if I say that? What if I look this way? You know, everything was subjected to multiple questions, which needed quick answers, like a lot of computing. Super. Yeah. I won't say I was smart, but my calculator head was taxed.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so then suddenly you're very conscious of the fact that that's what drinking and pot did for you.
The silence of it. And I'd like to say that I felt like I'd been released from the prison of my head.
Right.
You know.
And so then did you just kept doing it all the time?
Oh, it was on. This was my graduate degree, was drinking and just trying everything. And if you're in a graduate program, everybody drinks. Everyone does drugs. So I was completely unsupervised.
Right.
I'm not living at home. I don't have to answer to anybody. And I was having a blast trying everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. And all that puritanical attitude about, you know, drug went to the wayside. Suddenly, I get William Faulkner. All the drunk, you know,
right.
Hemingway. I get it. I understand. It gave them a new perspective, and that allowed them to write. And Cheech and Chong was funny.
Yeah.
Whereas I thought they were just... just the crappiest, stupidest crap before it, but now they were hilarious. Like, I would roar at Cheech and Chong movies.
So
I still do, actually. And I'm
sober. Never got into that. So what was your sort of substance of choice?
There in graduate school, it was liquor. I wasn't crazy about marijuana only because it made me a bit paranoid. And some people love it and they relax, and it made me a little paranoid. But so I tended to like the more upper thing, like mushrooms and mm-hmm. things, the stronger stuff and the more up stuff rather than the down. But which is strange because what I liked about liquor was the downness of it. I liked that. I just liked that fuzzy feeling. And by the way, I was never this is a delicious drinker. I was a Diamond Lane line up three so I can get there as fast as possible.
Right.
That was me.
Do you think of yourself as a person who is pepped up and needs relaxing, or a person who is relaxed and needs pepping up, or neither?
I'm gonna go with D. No, I'm gonna go with C, Alex. Do you mean now or back then?
In general,
I can. Depending on the situation, I can rise to the peppiness.
I think of you as peppy.
Right, you think of me as peppy, and you know what? In general, I am. Mm-hmm. And when people see me, they're like, "You're always so happy." I get that a lot. You're always so happy, but the reality is, I am happy.
Right.
That's the. I mean, there's no There's no falseness right. to it. I genuinely am happy. And the day I got sober, I was happy. I was scared because I didn't know how I was going to, what I was going to do, what life was going to be like. But that was the beginning of. They talk about a pink cloud. Seriously, I'm still on a pink cloud. It's never gone, because when I wake up in the morning and I realize that I'm sober, I said everything else today is frosting. Because that is so astonishing that I get to be alive and sober, and that's the truth. And then, of course, life gets in the way during the day, and I'll be annoyed by, I'll get a splinter, and that'll annoy me. But when I go to sleep, I pray twice a day, mm-hmm. and when I go to sleep, I just say that I have such gratitude. I'm very grateful. I'm a hugely grateful person.
Jesus, you might be the happiest sober person I know.
It's unbelievable. I was like in an octopus's arms and going down in a riptide. Really, it's amazing.
Do you think you have an abnormal amount of serotonin running through your veins?
It's funny because, the particular drugs that I was drawn to are serotonin. They affect serotonin uptake. As they call it, I love it, inhibitors.
Yes, yes, yes.
And if this is me, with inhibited serotonin.
But yet, ironically, okay, you were not. Because here is also what's interesting is I don't talk to many people who say, I got along with my family great. I love them so much.
Yeah.
You actually come from a family that sounds quite functional and quite happy.
It is. I mean there's dynamics that I wouldn't call it dysfunction, but there's all that. And by the way, all this did impact my relationship with my family. I got more and more remote from them because my biggest fear when I started to realize I might have a problem or maybe I'm drinking too much and drugging too much, my biggest fear was that my family would find out. Mm-hmm. Biggest fear. Mm-hmm. Because the twistedness of the disease led me to think they would somehow reject me, when in fact my family would pick me up and say, how can we help you? What mm-hmm. can we do to help? But in my mind, it's like they find out they're going to reject me, which is crazy.
And none of them ever had, like, where is alcoholism in your family?
There is some element of it. Although I probably want to be discreet and not
go into it. Oh, interesting. Okay. But even people I know who don't have it in their family, there's some alcohol.
Right. You can always find it somewhere. I mean, I literally don't know if it's genetic. It wasn't within necessarily my immediate family that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And I don't think my parents have ever, because neither of my parents drank. I mean, they just didn't drink. But, so I don't know. But there were interesting dynamics,
But the sense I get overall is that that you feel very loved by them.
Oh gosh,
and, and we're
very Jewish families tend to be tight. Orthodox Jewish families tend to be really tight to the point of smothering.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I'm making fun of that, but my family was not smothering. My family was really, it's a great family. It's really we're very.
Can I come to a Sunday dinner? I mean, that's how great they sound.
Yeah, no, they are good. My dad's passed, but you can. We'll put his picture up.
And I'll still come.
Or we'll bring someone who will tell you about him.
So you then, in graduate school, did you start doing meth then?
No, I didn't do meth until I graduated mm-hmm. and came back to L.A.
Okay, so here you come back to L.A.
Come back to L.A. and not only come back to L.A., but I've got this career, this amazing career handed to me by the universe.
Because you started working for the Farrelly brothers there?
I met Peter Farrelly the first day of graduate school.
Hate you.
We became friends.
Because he was in the program, in the graduate program?
He was in my program, first day, first class. In fact, here's how we met, because it's a cute little story. The teacher, I'm not going to say his name because he's still alive, but he's
obviously a listener. Go on.
Was a novelist, and he was a little hefty, a little heavy set. Mm-hmm. And the assignment for the first day was supposed to bring in the first page of your short story, and we were going to read the first page out loud, and then we would see what assumptions we can make about the rest of the story from that first page. And I remember Peter was sitting across from me. I didn't know anybody. I'm out of the nest. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be more in an awkward social situation for me. And the teacher, somebody read their first page, and the teacher said, I like this first page very... This is exactly what he sounded like. I hope to gosh he's never hears that. I like this first page very much, but... And I have one very big but. And Peter and I were looking at each other when he said that. We were like... We just started like... And he's like, well, what? I'm like, nothing. And right after class, I went up to him and I said, big butt, he had a big butt. He's like, I know, we shook hands. That's we met.
I love
literally,
that.
Right in that class.
I love that story. So, and where was Bobby Farrelly?
Bobby came in later. Bobby was going to Brown. Is Brown in Providence?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, he was going to Brown. And he was a business major. I mean, in fact, we went to his graduation. Okay, let's go back to Peter for a second, because that'll lead to Bobby. So, Peter and I were great friends, and we decided that because of our rather bizarre, twisted sense of humor, we should write something together, write a movie together. I had no connection to film.
And he didn't either.
No, he grew up in Providence, but he grew up in Rhode Island.
The story I always heard about the Farrelly brothers is they sold meat by the side of the road. Is that true?
I have never heard that story.
I remember, but
that's a good one. I think didn't they say that about me? No, I don't know.
I know.
I've never heard that. No.
That's the story about West Hollywood, right?
Yeah, I bought meat by the side of the road.
Okay,
I never paid anyhow.
Okay,
but,
good to know.
So Peter, at one point, Peter needed to get a TA to stay in. They needed to stay in the program because it was expensive. He needed a TA to help support, and they didn't give it to him. They had some. I don't know what they had against Peter, but it pissed me off. And so he went and got into Columbia,
and
ended up being the star of the Columbia program. Won the Peter Benchley Award that year and everything. I mean, they loved him at Columbia. So now he was in New York, and we had started writing the script while he was living in Amherst. So I would go to New York weekends. He'd come to Amherst, and we wrote this ridiculous comedy together. It was called Dust to Dust. It was about two idiots who... It had nothing to do with Dumb and Dumber.
Okay.
Two idiots who get involved with a funeral home that's an undercover for the mob, and they're selling cocaine and all this stuff. And now, what do we do with the script?
Mm-hmm.
So, we're coming to the end... I'm coming to the end of my...
Program.
Right. It's 1985, right? And we were coming home... I was coming home for the holidays, and then there'd be just like 1 or 2 months, and then we're done. And so, we're covering two coasts now. On the East Coast, Peter had a date with this girl, and he was telling her that he'd written a script, and she said, "Oh, you know what? My Eddie Murphy just moved in next door to my parents in Alpine, New Jersey." And he said, "Really? Do you ever see him?" She said, "Yeah, I saw him like coming out to get his paper the other day." And he said, "Yeah, take our script." And he gave her our script.
God.
And he said, "If you ever see him." Like, a week or two later, she called and said, he was washing his car, so I came over and gave him your script. Okay, that was probably in, like, October of 1985. Meanwhile, I go home for Christmas, Hanukkah. Yeah, see how several years out of my Orthodox home, I'm already forgetting what the holiday is.
Yeah.
And my sister, Freda, was a big folk dancer. She'd love to go Israeli dancing and folk dancing, and she knew David Zucker.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Freddie, would you ask David Zucker if he'd read our script?" And she asked him. He said, "Sure, I'll take a look at it." And so we gave him our script. Didn't hear anything more from anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Graduate school is over. It's finished. I'm about to leave Amherst. I go on one trip. I send myself on a trip to... Cancun. I meet some friends in Cancun. I go to Cancun, have a great time. Come back. Now I have like 2 days before I'm moving back to LA. I get Montezuma's Revenge. There's no reason for this detail.
Right.
Except to tell you that I grabbed... I ran into my apartment because I knew this was an accident in progress.
Yeah.
It was 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Grabbed my mail and sat on the toilet for like...
Okay. Got it.
Half an hour going through my mail.
Yeah.
Right. And there's this letter from my dad. And I go, what the heck is... I open it up, and inside is the LA Times. Like, he literally had torn the paper.
Yeah.
And he said, "Call me when you read this." He says, "Is this your script?"
What?
And this is the letter. This is how the article opened. This is after Eddie Murphy had done Beverly Hills Cop, and he was the hottest.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy was looking out the window of his Alpine, New Jersey home when he saw something that made his heart sink. It was a neighbor coming across the street with the script in his hand. The neighbor gave the script to Murphy, gave the script called Dust to Dust to Murphy, and now, so here's what happened. Murphy had read it, loved it,
okay.
Lost it, sort of tried to remember our names. They checked all over town, couldn't find anyone with our names, and they planted this article to get us to call in.
Why didn't he ask the neighbor, the girl?
I don't know. Because she moved to Europe. We didn't have any.
Yeah.
Probably about 3 years ago, she finally got in touch with Peter after all these years.
After making his career, right.
And in the meantime, David Zucker contacted Freda and said, We love this script.
Oh,
we want your brother and his friend to write a movie for us.
That's crazy.
That's when I moved back to LA. Peter moved out with me.
Yeah.
And we lived together in Santa Monica. And we started writing a movie for Eddie Murphy and a movie for the Zucker brothers. And that's how we started. Yeah.
So what happened with those movies?
Nothing. As typical.
As that happens, yeah.
The thing we wrote for Eddie Murphy, he wanted to direct it. And it was there was no part. It was about teenagers who are like Robin Hoods. It was called Young Robbers, and he wanted to direct it. Of course, all they wanted him to do was star in movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they kept pushing it away, you know.
Yeah.
And he would say, well, "I want to direct this," and you know, we developed it a bit more with him, but nothing happened with that. And then with the Zuckers, that was for Disney, and it just fell through. It was called. It was a prison comedy. I think it was untitled prison comedy. But
mm-hmm.
We worked with them. They asked us. We read Ruthless People and threw a few jokes into that.
I remember that.
Yeah, and then we did a couple of TV pilots with them. We co-wrote some stuff. There's one thing that was now it's almost prescient that we did it then. It's called Our Planet Tonight, and it was a parody of news information shows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but okay, and so then.
And then go ahead, because I know you want to get to Bobby somehow.
I do want to get to Bobby, but yeah. I remember when I first moved to LA reading Peter Farrelly's novel.
Yes.
That was about, I still remember.
Which, Outside Providence or The Comedy Writer?
The Comedy Writer.
Yes,
The
Comedy Writer is like, there's so much in that that's reality.
I would bet. But the thing I really remember was that he had a friend who was a struggling actor, and he was the struggling writer, I guess. And that the friend always complained that there was nothing for a struggling actor to do, that at least the struggling writer had stuff to do because
right.
he
you
could
can
write.
Yes.
And I remember a hot tub. That's all I remember about the entire thing.
Yeah, yeah. That book was funny because, in fact, his first book, Outside Providence, which he was writing when we were in graduate school, he read it to me it was handwritten.
Yeah.
He read me the pads. I remember the night he read it to me at my place, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it's so exciting to get the behind the scenes or
so exciting.
Yeah, and then Bobby. See, so Bobby, at a certain point, we started letting Bobby read our scripts because he would always have great notes and really funny input.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point, we were writing. I mean, Peter and I were writing together for years, and then we were writing for. We were going to do Dragnet 2, sequel to Dragnet at mm-hmm. Universal. And we said, let's have Bobby write it with us. You know, can he join us? And I said, absolutely. He's been great. And that's when I don't think, it's unbelievable that we did this because we didn't do it in any kosher way. After we had written it, we said, Bobby wrote it with us and he's part of our team now.
And they would never let that fly today.
Never, no.
Yeah.
And our poor agent, our first agent is now the head of Creative Art. Our first agent was Richard Lovett.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we drove Richard crazy.
Yeah.
We drove him crazy.
Right.
Like, he had a birthday, and Peter and I said, let's go get a blow-up doll and fill it with helium. That'll be his birthday his birthday balloon. We thought it would float. Well, helium will not make it. I guess the vinyl of a blow-up doll is a little thicker than you. She's got a thicker skin than we thought. So she was just sort of limply posed.
He didn't enjoy the gift.
I don't think he thought. I think it was a little too over the top for that staid environment. But
yes.
I remember we brought her up on, like, Pete had her on his neck in the elevator. This is when they were. They weren't in Century City. No, they were. They were in a bit, not the place where they are in Century City.
They were in a different place in Century City.
Before they moved to, like, Wilshire. And,
yeah. So.
So Bobby joined us, and from that point on, he wrote with us. And then the reason I left
yeah
the reason I left the partnership was I was crazy out of my mind on drugs.
Okay, this is interesting.
Yes, now we can see how it all.
Because I do know that it was the Farrelly brothers and not Yellen, Farrelly, and Farrelly.
It was Farrelly and
Yellen.
When
I first heard of them. Yeah.
Right. It was Farrelly and Yellen. And then, and we wrote Dumb and Dumber for Universal.
Okay.
We wrote it for Universal, and then they didn't want it. They kind of, a deal changed, and the producer of it sort of fell through the cracks and everything. So nothing happened with it. And so about a year later, I was gone. At this point, I was gone. I had left L.A. I got involved with a crazy, crazy person.
Okay.
And was involved with him for like almost 5 years.
And where did you go?
I moved to Cape Cod.
Okay.
With him. This is the nature of how crazy he was and I was. He was actually seeing somebody else as well there at Cape Cod, and he told the person that at Cape Cod, my friend is going to come visit, and he's going to bring all my furniture out from L.A., but I thought I was moving out there to be with him.
Right.
And when I got there, we were staying with his friend who thought I was his, we were staying with the guy he was dating, who thought I was just a friend. And the guy, we started talking, I said, wait, you're dating him? I'm dating him too. But I brought all his furniture out, thank goodness, because I thought we were moving out.
And so then what happened once you all put it together?
He blew his top.
He blew his top.
He got angry at me. He tried to, the best way to put this is and not being delicate, he did try to kill me. He was literally choking me.
Oh, God.
I was blacking out, and I got him off me, and that was the end of, we broke up.
Yeah.
Basically, that led to a breakup.
I'm just glad it did, frankly.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, sorry, I need water for
this.
I know,
after something like that, that's dramatic.
I felt like I was being choked.
I need
to drink some water.
It's like,
But 5 years away, that doesn't sound like 5 years. That sounds like that sounds like a month. Did it take 5 years for that to happen in Cape Cod?
We were off and on.
Okay,
it was a month.
Yeah.
It was literally a month in Cape Cod where it finally came to a head, where we realized and by the way, the guy who he was dating and I are very good friends. We're like best friends now.
Wow.
Yeah.
What happened to the crazy?
We have no idea.
Yeah.
There's only two things that make sense because of the way he operated and his lifestyle. He's either
dead.
Incarcerated or dead.
Yeah.
It's one of the two. There's no other. He cannot possibly be just like teaching kindergarten somewhere.
Right.
It's not,
let's hope not.
No.
Anyway. So you have left this thriving career.
I left the thriving career. Yes, and I was crazy. And talk about, I mean, trying to hold things together. This guy who I was dating, we would have these knockdown, drag-out, screaming fights, and then at 11 o'clock, Peter and Bobby would show up and we'd be riding. You know, I mean, this is where the exterior Bennett does not represent interior Bennett.
Right.
And you know, apparently they didn't know what was going on. I mean, Peter said that he sensed an angst, but he thought that was just because he knew that he knew I was gay, although I hadn't quite come out.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of knew that this guy was probably my boyfriend. And he thought that because I was gay and Jewish, that I was just going through angst that way. He didn't realize that it was drug-related.
Right.
Yeah.
So when did you start doing the meth in a serious way?
I started doing the meth in a serious way. Like at first, it was not in a serious way. It was like in a fun way. No, but I mean,
guys,
it's true. I met this guy who I dated. I bought it from him. It was probably the third time I'd done some, or maybe even the second, but I bought some from him. And then he was seeing somebody else, but we'd meet in decent places and get drugs. And so I started that.
So PSA, don't start dating your drug dealer.
No, it's not as convenient as you think it's going to be. No, there's a price you pay besides not paying any price. You know, I mean,
that's
comes
a good motto.
Out,
if
yeah,
only it
right.
was. A, if only we needed to create an ad for this.
Exactly. Well, maybe we will.
Maybe we will.
Let's hold on to that.
Yeah.
Possible. Let's not toss that one away.
No. So you go to buy meth only the second or third time you've done it. That's
yes.
how much you liked it.
Yes, I liked it, but what seems kind of sort of typical for meth users is it's recreational at first, and you think you can control the intake. And I only did it like on the week because it was never it required recovery time too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not like something that wore off. For me, it's hours. And you know, we're talking hours and hours and hours, like 12, even more hours. And so I'd have to do it on the weekend and have that time to recover, and
mm-hmm.
I couldn't sleep at all. Couldn't sleep. So yeah, but then as I started to realize I was doing it more, you know, and I had friends who were doing it too, but we'd do it at the same pace. And then I started to sense, and a thick kind of dull realization that maybe I'm doing this a little more.
Yeah.
I kind of like it's like two trains that,
yeah.
that and you don't feel you're doing anything wrong until you're pulling ahead and leaving everyone behind. That,
yeah.
That's kind of what it felt like.
And you were doing it on your own, I would imagine, by that point.
I was doing it on my own, but,
yeah.
but always there was... It was always with a sexual element
mm-hmm.
combined. It was always to meet to for sex, but when what really was beneath all that was it was always to connect
mm-hmm.
connect to somebody and
mm-hmm.
and to, it's just so it's it, there's a such a sadness about the idea that it was kind of like I was wrapped in bubble wrap and wanted to connect with
mm-hmm.
someone else who was wrapped in bubble wrap, you know. Beneath it, that's what I wanted, was a connection with another human being. That there was no way you could get it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you could get it with this kind of behavior and this kind of, you know, false, artificial energy and, you know.
Well, and plus those drugs, sort of, especially meth, you know, make, you may want a connection, but meth will sexualize that.
Oh,
regardless.
Yes. It was always like right. And by the way, there was always the paranoia of it too. So I wanted to isolate. I wanted to just be with somebody and be indoors somewhere and
yeah.
not have to go out, not have to get gas or get food. Or well, I didn't need to worry about food
or gas because
or gas. Where am I going to go? But I was very much. I'm always a paranoid drug user.
Yes,
yeah.
me too.
Never. Relax, you know, like I could be out and go, nobody knows. The moment I opened that door, I'm like, everybody
yeah.
knows, you know.
Yeah.
It reached a point where I was so terrified to walk from my door to the car, which was about 25 feet, that I wouldn't. Like I thought my landlord who lived behind me, I thought he's going to see me. And the paranoia was, that's where the towels came up.
I remember those days. But I was convinced that I was getting evicted all the time. Did you have that?
No, I didn't think I was getting convicted and even I didn't think I was getting evicted. But if I had a guest,
mm-hmm.
I was so self-conscious about someone coming in, like someone coming in to my place, like when someone was there, when I'm high and with somebody else, that I'd be constantly like straining to listen. I'd be like,
yeah.
stop talking, because I have to listen really carefully.
To nothing.
I wouldn't say that, but that's
yeah.
what I'm thinking. Like, quiet, stop breathing so heavily. I can't tell if there's someone at the door with the key. Because I had like an ex had the key,
yeah.
that, you know, and I thought, someone's coming over and I'll be discovered.
So, and would you do those like meth projects where you would take apart things?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I was a lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was all about meeting somebody. It was
right.
not a project person at all.
Okay.
I couldn't concentrate. I didn't write on it.
Right.
No. It wasn't at all helpful for me to focus in that way.
And so was Peter going, hey Bennett, where are you?
At a certain point I did have like sort of an intervention with Peter and Bobby saying, look, we know what happens with me is when people would say we think we know what's up, I would like say you're right,
mm-hmm.
and so, but I'm okay. It's going to be okay. Like I can handle this. So I don't think that he knew it was the drug so much, but it was more of an intervention about this crazy boyfriend. He's crazy. He's not good for you. We checked up on all. You know, he talked about his family. We checked up on the history. It's all baloney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to be away from him. I'd say I will be, and I'd break up with the guy for a month or two, and
mm-hmm.
then we get back together again. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, getting back together again, we decided to move, you know, do the classic, what's it called when you move away?
Geographic.
The classic geographic. If we just move together someplace else, everything
yeah.
would be fine. Classic.
So then...
So that was what, they were more aware of the angst related to the relationship and not to the drug
yeah.
fueled reason why that was part of what was going on.
And probably you were the same. You didn't realize that it was drug the drugs were the problem.
Or
you did.
I wouldn't say that it was a cloud that was, I was unable to differentiate the elements of the cloud, but
right.
I knew that drugs were a part of it.
And
know?
so we talked about that serotonin running through your veins.
Yeah.
Were you depressed during this period?
Oh, horrible depression.
Okay.
And I was going to a psychiatrist who prescribed. I was taking antidepressants during this time.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, I started seeing a therapist. And by the way, I was in a relationship. No, this was after the crazy guy. After he tried to kill me, I got in my car and drove. I kept driving. I was completely compassless. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I kept saying, and this was, by the way, that was January 4th, 1993?
Wow.
Or, 93. And I said, I'm going to keep driving until I hit somewhere where the temperature is over 60 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was Florida. So,
okay, you drove that direction. Okay.
And my best friend's mother lived in Florida, so I stayed with her for a few weeks. And during the course of that time, I met somebody
mm-hmm.
and moved in with him. And
wow.
we were together for years. And while we were together, we moved back to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
because Dumb and Dumber, the movie, got picked up to be made.
And that was a script you had written with the with
right.
both of them.
Right. We all three of us had written it together
mm-hmm.
at Universal. And then Peter and Bobby said, let's try and see if we can get this movie made. We went around town. Everyone rejected it 10 times,
mm-hmm.
except for Motion Picture Corporation,
mm-hmm.
a little tiny independent company. And New Line was, once somebody else was interested, New Line became interested too. So they signed on. So as that was going to go into production.
And
that
was the first movie
that
was getting made of yours.
Right. I mean, we'd done rewrites on movies that had, some movies that had been made. We'd done television stuff. And then we'd written piles of scripts. Back then, you would open your mouth and development money would just flitter into it.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable the millions that studios would spend developing projects. It was a whole different era.
Did
you
make
a whole
ton of money?
Yes. And you could have a whole career just writing movies or rewriting movies that never got made.
Yeah.
A whole career.
Isn't
you could
that
sell things
still?
Off of pitches.
Hear that people have entire careers never getting anything made. But it's less
they
true,
do it
certainly.
Less because they just don't want to spend money on something that doesn't that's gonna fall through. So they're trying to make what they're
make
spending
sense.
Their money for. No, I'm not holding it against
them.
I just like the fluffier time.
Did you get to buy really cool things or did you spend it all on drugs?
I pretty much bought. I mean, nothing I bought was like I didn't buy property or anything
right.
like that. But everything I bought was just a silly like an electronic gadget or something. I was never in need of anything, and I certainly
right.
didn't need the things that I bought.
Right.
But I never felt like I was hugely struggling. I thought I had a pretty good career.
Yes, you
yeah.
did. And
yeah.
so then they say Dumb and Dumber is getting made.
Yes,
and you're living in Florida.
I'm living in Florida, so I said I should probably. Is that?
You did not turn your phone off, but I forgive you.
That's okay. I didn't think anyone would call. I have a flash on it.
I know.
Isn't that
very, very popular.
Nice.
I can't imagine why you thought no one would call. Go on.
Because no one would call me this early. Except probably my sponsee, but I'll listen to it on the way to work. Wait, what was the question? Oh,
the question was, you're living in Florida,
yes.
and they call.
And I said, let's move back to L.A. I mean, the movie's getting made, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have the gumption to ask, can I join the
production,
the team again?
Yeah.
Although if I had, that's a big element of, this is a big part of the sweetness of what I want to talk about, because this is like a bookend of my life,
mm-hmm.
talking about this, and then we're going to talk about Dumb and Dumber 2, because that's the sweet bookend.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a space of such low self-esteem and humiliation and embarrassment that I did not ask in any way to be much of a creative part of Dumb and Dumber. I mean, I was there for whatever rewriting we had to do, but I didn't go. I spent like three days on set in
mm-hmm.
Utah. That was it, because I was so embarrassed. I was still doing drugs at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Once we got back to LA, I held off for a few months, and then I went out and got meth. I'm in a relationship and got meth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just too scared that it was too much of a focus on me, and people would catch me, and
mm-hmm.
then I'd have to who knows what would happen, except that my family would find out and it would be a disaster. Always, that was always the brick wall of terror.
Right.
Family's going to find out, you know.
And mom.
Right?
Hi, mom.
Hi, mom. Yeah.
Glad you know now. So yeah. Then, but you still are, it's the three of you that got credit on
it. Because we wrote it. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we wrote it together. And by the way, I could have had as much of a creative part of that
right.
as I want. But then also, that was their first movie.
Yeah.
And since then, you know, everyone was terrified because, I mean, nobody knew it was going to be a hit. We thought the script was funny.
Yeah.
We were thrilled that we had Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels because we loved both of them. But nobody knew.
Yeah.
You can't make a hit. You don't make a hit and know you're making a hit.
Yeah.
It's something that's only in retrospect, you know, and that's why, who knew that people, you know, the most famous line from the movie is that was improvised and it's a ridiculous
line.
What
is it?
It's when he comes out of the 7-Eleven and these guys with Slurpees goes, "Hey guys, oh, Slurpee."
That's the most famous line.
Yeah. Oh, big gulps. No, he goes, "Oh, big gulps." That's the most famous line. Why would anyone,
right.
I mean, that
well,
that says a lot about the people who think that's the most funniest thing in it. But.
Well, I mean, and especially a movie like that, which was, you know, and that's true of anything that's completely unique, is you have no
Didn't think it was
idea.
Unique. We just thought it was funny and
we
were just making it, you know, and couldn't, who would ever think it would catch on, you know?
And then it was this huge thing. Huge.
Yeah. It wasn't just that it did well when it came out, which was great. It's that it had some bizarre staying power.
Yeah, cult classic.
Right, and that's, you can't possibly create that.
Yeah.
Which was a weird thing to keep in mind when we were writing the second one, because we're like, we didn't have to deal with any of that. None of that, quote, pressure. Ultimately, we said, we just need to filter all that out and do what we feel is the movie we want to see. And if we do that, hopefully, if people liked our sensibility from the first one, they'll like the second one. That's pretty much how the second one was made. But
so,
hugely creatively involved. I moved back here and I started. I called up a friend of mine another friend of mine from graduate school who moved back here, and he was writing. I said, "Do you want to write together?" And his name is Mark Stylin. So we started writing together. So he became my second writing partner, after Peter and Bobby. Well,
and so then when did you get sober? How far after Dumb and Dumber?
Dumb and Dumber was made in 93, made during 93, released in 94, or was it? It was made.
It was released later.
It was released in December of 94, December 17, 1994. Yeah.
Okay.
And I didn't get sober until
2002,
right? And I'm off and on. Remember, I was in this relationship.
Yeah.
I started to go to a therapist. I had the dark night of the soul with that relationship was that I was in. I'm writing with this partner Mark who lives in San Diego, so I'd go to San Diego for the weekends to write with him. When we were writing something for New Line, we actually were successful. I mean, we were hired to write things, and. I had gotten meth, and I went to a bathhouse, and I talked to my boyfriend, who didn't know any of this, excuse me, and I remember I said, the night before I went out, I said, he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to go see this movie," and I'd always check the paper to, you know, like, get my lies straight, and then when I talked to him the next day, he said, "So what did you do last night?" And I said, "Oh, I went to," and he said, "What about the movie?" I said, "I didn't see that movie." And suddenly there was a crack in my lies, and then I kind of corrected myself or whatever. And that night I went to sleep, and it all poured in, all the guilt and shame poured into that crack. And I said this only happened. It's the only time I actually remember thinking this. If I do not call him and tell him the truth, I'm going to kill myself. But the awful. I feel so bad about lying to him. And I called him and made the choice to call him, and I chose life. And thank you. And bring the music, cue the music.
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, come back to LA and we'll talk about work it. We'll try and work it out. And you should probably get some therapy." So I started going to a therapist at that point. Started to see a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
This was about the time the movie Clerks came out, because that was the movie I lied about. Clerks. Yeah.
Okay.
And so I started seeing a therapist, and that's kind of important because I was going to therapy while I was using. You know, I would come in and fall asleep on the couch. I'd been up all weekend, and we would try and, like, bracket my using.
Oh, the therapist knew?
Yeah, oh yeah, I was telling her, yes, because that I was keeping, throughout all this, I kept the tip of a toe in reality.
Right.
You know, someone or something was keeping me, you know, yoked to the truth in some tiny way.
Right.
But I'd say, like, I use on the weekends, and she said, well, then we need to see each other, like, Wednesdays and Fridays, just before the weekend. And, you know, I'd use on the weekend. I'd fall, several times I fell asleep on the couch. I just remember this gentle, like, Bennett, I think our session is over. She was a very gentle
one. Yeah, she sounds compassionate.
She was great. She really saved my life. I mean, she was fantastic. And she ultimately, we'll get to the moment where because there's a moment I got sober. The moment I got sober was, should we just run to that?
Yeah, let's run to that.
Okay, so at this point in my life now, I'm literally look at a calendar and I say, do you need to be available for that event? If you have to, you cannot be using this like a week before. You need to clear it because I was so, that's how hard it was for me to, and the illusion that I was actually like somehow planning it when in fact it was always in control of me. But there was I had an aunt who, it was her 90th birthday, and again, my family, I was not seeing them a lot, and they were aware that I wasn't seeing them, and it was causing a lot of stress. They didn't know why. I wasn't prepared. I certainly wasn't ready to tell them. But I had a fantasy. This made it, again, the genius, the brilliance of my addiction. It's so crafty and so clever. My addiction said, if all you have to do, they're going to rescue you. They're going to rescue you. Mm-hmm. So all you have to do is just keep doing what you're doing, and at some point they'll rescue you. Mm-hmm. They'll see it. It's up to them to see it. And they'll, it was so, what a great way to keep dragging it out. I didn't have to do anything.
Right.
But there was always a paranoia when I'd get together with them that they were going to see. You know, there was the tension, fear. And so I had to go to an aunt's birthday party. 90 years old. I'm like, you can't say no to a 90 birthday party. So, and then of course, it was on a Sunday. By Thursday of the week before, I'm off and running. And I'm up all weekend. All weekend. No sleep. Sunday morning rolls around. And I'm like, I remember literally looking in the mirror, arguing with myself, you can't go. You look terrible. Like just horrible. You know. And you have to go. It's her 90th. There's not going to be a 91. She lived longer, thank God.
Right.
But,
predicted just like a hit. Can't predict
it. And I said, you got to go. You finally have to go. So I shaved. I'm driving down to Santa Monica. And on the way, this kind of a grace and a kind of comfort fell over me because I thought, this is it. And I'm walking in, I'm not going to say it literally, but I'm saying it figuratively by my presence, the way I look, Bennett, your son needs help.
Right.
And so, great, okay. And then I'm going to come back, I'm going to pack, and I'll go to rehab because I'm willing to do it.
I mean, wow.
Again, as long as they don't yell at me.
Yeah.
As long as I'm that, it's like the little kid who falls through the ice. And they don't, when they rescue them, they don't go, why you freaking fall through the ice?
Right.
They're like, they put a blanket on them and they take care of them. That was my disease's great theory, is that we'll skip over the anger or the asking why you are an addict and just go right to, let's get you some help.
Right.
So I go to the thing, I make it through this thing, through this birthday party. It was on the most, I'll still say it was the most beautiful day. Maybe I'm a little, you know, my memory's a little, you know,
it was the most beautiful day you've ever seen.
Yeah, but it was the most gorgeous, sunny day, and I thought I'd be able to hide in the corners. Yeah. No, I am so exposed, and I'm driving home, and I'm like, there's going to be, I know I'm just going to go pack, and there's a message already from my mom on my machine, and it says, Bennett, Dad and I just wanted to say, we thought you looked great today.
Oh my God.
And I went to therapy the next day, Monday. That was the equivalent of, like, you're going to jump off the roof and the fire department gets back in the truck and leaves. I'm like, ah!
Right.
And I said, and my therapist said, you know, it's not their job to rescue you.
Yeah.
And it's not mine either. And I was just like, wow.
Yeah.
That's it. It's my job if I want it. And I had been going to meeting. I had been checking out meetings, meaning I had gone late, sat in the back, left early, there was always somebody. I had a drawer like with about five strips of paper with somebody saying, you know, if you need a, you want to talk to somebody. I went home, I opened the drawer, and guy Jason, who's this Jason, called Jason and said, mm-hmm. Hi, I need to get sober.
Mm-hmm. And you did.
And I did. That was it. That was the moment.
Really?
Was,
and you never went to treatment or anything?
Never went to treatment. No.
And?
No, I'm sorry. You know what? I apologize. When I was with the boyfriend after, during therapy, I said, I went to something called Matrix, UCLA.
Oh, yeah.
And I did Matrix, which you can't drink or do drugs while you're doing Matrix. But when I got out of Matrix, I didn't go to any program.
Because they don't go to programs.
It's not necessary. My memory is they strongly suggest it, but it's not required.
Okay.
But you aren't allowed, because they drug test you, to do drugs or drink while you're going. And so when I got out of Matrix, I just drank.
Yeah.
I just didn't do the crystal meth. And we were together, that boyfriend and I, for a few more years.
Mm-hmm.
Then we broke up. And as soon as we broke up, I'm like, I wasn't doing it because of him.
Right.
I don't have any reason not to do it, and got back into it. So, but over the course of that, I attended a few meetings. So I had a drawer. Once again, why wouldn't I have thrown those numbers away?
Yeah, I did the same thing.
Yeah, little God spark.
Yeah, well, it's just we know before we're out of denial. Like, I think
yes,
we do know.
Right. Something deeper understands it. Yes.
So then, and so now, you're sober, thriving. We've already discussed how you're grateful
so
every
thriving,
day.
Yes.
And so Dumb and Dumber 2.
Yeah, that comes around, and here's, you talk about, you know, we have a process that there are in some programs there are steps, and one of the steps in one of those programs is to make an amends.
Yes.
And you can make a living amends to people, which a lot of people I did make a living amends to, including the Farrelly brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sat down with them and made an actual appropriate technical
mm-hmm.
one, but. When Peter called me and said, we're going to do Dumb and Dumber 2, I said to myself, this is the nature of your amends to them. You are going to be in the center of this boat. You are going to be there every single day, and you're going to give 100%, and you're going to, your presence is, that is what you can do to make the amends for leaving the partnership, for not being present during Dumb and Dumber. And I was there for, there was only 1 week I was gone, and that was I was sitting Shiva for my father.
Mm.
And in fact, I thought, oh, maybe I'll get a few more days out of this. By the evening of the seventh day, Pete calls me, he goes, when can you come back?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was there for, and I was, I to have the experience and to do it as a sober individual was profound. The gifts I got from it were, I mean, it's so abundant to be helped, you know, to be a what's it called, a fellow in my fellows.
Yeah.
I mean, to
worker among workers.
Worker among workers, to contribute creatively. I sat at that keyboard. I typed every single word, except for the week I was gone. I typed every word that we wrote. I mean, I was there for like about 2 weeks of the production. I could, just went and was a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the movie 3 times.
Nice.
One time you'll never know it's me because I'm peeing against the side of a building in the background as they go back on the pipe.
Okay.
The other two you can see me, but I mean, like, I'm all over the movie, and it's not an ego thing. The movie represents to me how you do something in sobriety, how you behave and function, and how you apply it to your life. I mean, I went into it. I was terrified going in. We're going to do a sequel to this, and what did I do with my fear? I gave it up. You know, every lesson, every tool that we pick up, a kind of simple tools. Every tool was applied to this and worked. You know, and I came out of it. It's just and the movie went through so it was an uphill struggle to get it made. Every left turn led to a better street, you know. So really amazing, because they ended up making the movie we wanted to make, which was really amazing because
first of all, we're back, you guys, so sorry for that sudden abandonment.
Technology could be so cruel.
Technology hates me. Bennett has just told me that I'm personalizing something that's not personal, that technology can't actually have feelings.
But wait a few years and it will, and then it might hate you.
Okay,
you're early on this.
You think?
Yeah.
And so then we started talking about driving and taking things personally, and Bennett was just telling this story about how
Should I tell again?
Tell it.
I'm driving and my cell phone rings. I pick it up and I look at who's calling. Caller ID. I look at who's calling and I'm like, oh, don't want to talk. I make an involuntary sour face, put it down, and a second later I hear beep, beep. The person who was calling me was next in the next lane, right next to me, saw the sour face. Then the phone rings again. It's him. I pick it up and he goes, busted!
Oh, that's amazing that he has a sense of humor.
And I said, I'm glad you have a sense of humor. I just wasn't. There's all these things. I rambled on an excuse, but that was a true busted moment. It don't happen often.
I had the exact same thing. I was walking near Ground Zero in New York with my friend Rachel, who was visiting me when I lived in New York. My phone rings. I look at it and I go, oh, God. And then I hear, Anna? And it was a person who just passed us walking.
So he didn't necessarily see the prune face.
I exclaimed, oh, God.
He or she, I don't know. Okay.
And then he walked forward and my friend I was with lost it completely, picked up exactly, it was on the floor banging on the ground, like laughing so hard.
All I can say is you have Ground Zero to blame for the oh God. I mean, you could have shunned it off that way. I have nothing. I was out there, I was raw.
How about it's dangerous to pick up the phone when driving?
Yeah, but that was back then. It was.
It was always dangerous.
It was always dangerous, but back then you didn't get, cited for it.
True, true. But, okay, but we're wrapping up and we're talking about, I know.
My gosh. So sad. Put a ring on it.
So we're wrapping up
a ribbon.
So Dumb and Dumber 2 is coming out in November. Right now you're writing with another writing partner.
With another writing partner who I've been writing with for about 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we want to write a comedy spec script.
Okay.
So that when Dumb comes out, we can take advantage of any kind of comedy momentum that my career might have as a result. So we're working on a spec.
Nice. And so you have such specific hours that you were like 11 to...
We do. We try and we write Monday through Friday from 11 to 6. Yeah. We try and be good about that.
And in terms of your sobriety, you credit your sobriety for...
Everything.
Really?
Yes. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I seriously would love to lobby Congress so that you can get, instead of a driver's license, instead of your you can change your birth date, if you're sober, to your date of sobriety. Not because I want to be younger, but because for me, that's truly, a rebirth, as far as I'm concerned. I mean,
March 4th.
What a great, I'm telling you. It's such a great, and by the way, when I was struggling, I would do things, I'd say, well, you're going to stop. But when I knew I was in trouble, I'd say, you're going to stop on January 1st. I'd I'd get like a ring and I'd have it and engraved with the date, January.
You did?
Oh yeah, I still have one of these somewhere. I probably have like three, and of course, it never worked.
That's a bad way to do it.
No, it's a bad way to do it.
You would engrave a non like program ring.
Get a ring. Yeah, and I know it's so ridiculous. And then like I'm gonna. It's so embarrassing to say that. I kept one because it's so embarrassing.
I knew a guy when I was new who had his sobriety date tattooed on his shoulder as like a, what's that called? The thing you scan at the supermarket?
Oh, yeah. I'll remember it. Literally, if you scanned it, the number would come up, or no? It was figurative.
You can't put a person through a supermarket scanner.
No, but you can't pick up the laser... the hand laser thing and scan it. Like they do that.
Okay, but let's assume it didn't do that. But I remember saying that's so cool. And somebody else said, someone wiser than me said, he's going to go out. Because you can't do that. And I never saw him again.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right, because the humiliation of having your sobriety.
No, it's not that. But it's sort of the perhaps not accepting one day at a time. Or it's like those people that join a gym and then go every day, till January 30th and never go again. I think it's maybe the marathon, not the race. I mean, who knows?
Here's the bigger question about sobriety. Why do you think... You can't answer this possibly, but I'm curious what you think about it.
Don't underestimate me.
Why do some people get it and some people don't? And there are people who try, like you see them try, and like there are people in my 12 plus years, there are people who have a few months, who've had a few months over 12 years.
I know.
And they keep coming, they're the ones who keep coming back, which right. is which blows my mind and always makes me very empathetic.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm frustrated, you know?
I don't know. Obviously, if people could explain this, then everybody would get sober. Every single person who needed to get sober would get sober. The way it makes sense in my head is some people have the disease worse than others. I mean, I know people who just have it worse. You talk to them, and the way they used and the way they think about it is worse.
Well, maybe their lives were a lot worse, leading to them using. Like the build up to using as a prescription for getting through life.
I don't think it's that. I don't think it's that because I know people with horrible lives.
Yeah, who are sober.
Who have managed to make them good through sobriety. I don't know. I mean, maybe people, you know, their tolerance for pain is higher.
Well, I don't. You know, a lot of the program literature is. When I first was trying to read it, it was like warm milk. I'd fall asleep. I literally, my eyes would roll in my head. And then when I had some sobriety and read it, it was incredibly insightful into human behavior. And the one thing that they say is there are those two who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that is the truth about getting it or not. If there's a layer you can't crack open to allow yourself to be, you have to get to a true, you know, humility, you know, esteem shredding honesty. And if you can't do that, or if it's covered for whatever reason because you've had to build a very thick layer around it, I think that that's very much an element of whether you can or can't stay sober.
I don't know that I agree. I think that that's oversimplifying. I know people who can't stay sober who are capable of this sort of honesty I can't even believe. We have to stop. We've been talking way too long.
Why didn't you stop me an hour ago? When it would have made more sense.
Because it would have been a 7-minute podcast.
Exactly.
That wouldn't have worked. No, Bennett, you are a delight. You continue to be a delight.
Thank you. You are just... I wish you could... No photograph captures the luminosity of Anna David in person.
What a great note to
end. Isn't that sweet? Yeah.
So you heard it here first. If you can be grateful every day and be on a pink cloud, you too can write the funniest movie of all time. That's not true, but Bennett Yellen is a special, special guy. I'm sure you know that now. And go. Get your ticket now to Dumb and Dumber 2, okay? Bennett Yellen, After Party Pod.